It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
Welcome to episode number 17 of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. I'm Matt Wardlaw, and with me, at least for today, is Jeff Giles. I know that sounds ominous, Jeff, but I don't mean it that way.
What do you mean, at least for today? What do you know that I don't know?
Don't worry about it. But hey, you know what, Jeff? The number of today's episode makes me smile. Can you guess why?
I think I can. I think I can.
You can guess this one. Obviously, the reason would be because it reminds me of the album Chicago 17, which was the first time that I heard the drumming of our guest today. I think I bought the 45 of Stay the Night first, took it home, listened to that drum opening over and over again, and as the tune continued to build, I thought that was about the coolest thing I'd ever heard on that particular day. And on the flip side was the B-side, a tune called Only You, and that was kind of my first experience of, I guess, getting something extra with, you know, in addition to buying the song that you already knew, which in this case was Stay the Night. And it was all enough to make me go out and buy that Chicago 17 album on cassette. And that's where it started.
You,
Jeff,
and about, what, 10 million other people, right?
Exactly. You know, but it began there, a lifetime of being a Chicago fan. But I have to tell you, I don't know how aware you were of this at that point, but when I bought that album, I didn't think too much about the number 17 and the fact that there might be 16 albums that had come before that.
I was a little more fortunate. I had access to my parents' vinyl collection.
Nice.
I think I picked up the thread with 16 instead of 17, but 17 was definitely a pivotal moment in my musical youth. Although it's one that I think is a little ironic for Danny Serafine, because if I remember right, I don't know how much he actually played in terms of traditional drumming on that record. I think a lot of it was programmed, which for a talented drummer such as himself had to have been a little difficult to deal with at the time.
Well, I think we can get into that with Danny here in just a second. I will tell you that the other part of my childhood was that my parents on occasion would take me to thrift shops where I discovered that you could, you know, buy, you know, lots of vinyl for a cheap price. And so I was there in the thrift shop one particular day, and I going through the stacks of albums, and there is this album that has the Chicago logo front and center, which blew my mind. I'm going, wait a second, I thought this band was new, you know, but I see this album, which is marked Chicago Transit Authority. Clearly this is the same band, and right behind it there's Chicago 2 and Chicago 3 and a copy of Chicago Live at Carnegie Hall. So I took all that home, Jeff, and my mind was blown. Like, I discovered Chicago truly on that day, no doubt. So,
yeah.
But, hey, you and I mean, I think the point of all this is that you and I with Chicago, the way some kids were collecting baseball cards with the ability to reel off a team's lineup at a moment's notice, that's how we were with the members of Chicago. And, you know, we have gone backwards and forwards, you know, learning as much as we could about this band. But for me, I don't think it was really until a couple years ago when Danny put out his book that there was really some concrete details as far as how it all happened, how it all came together, and, you know, all the rest of that. So
it's very true.
So so it's very cool to have Danny with us here today.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning. You're setting me off to an auspicious start here, huh? Chicago 17. Wow. Right into the frying pan. You guys don't mess around, do you? I like that, though. That's okay.
Now, am I remembering right? Did you actually program the bulk of that record?
A lot of it, yes. And I didn't play on, you know, I had a big falling out with David Foster, and it got really pretty ugly. And so what happened to be our most successful record, I did, you know, Jeff Porcaro played on Stay the Night, which, you know, it's a great drum part. I mean, it's a fabulous drum part, but it's not me. And Carlos Vega played on You're the Inspiration. I played on, you know, the rest of, you know, I played on Hard Habit to Break, and got in the rest of the program, the Along Comes a Woman, and there was a bunch of stuff I programmed. What kind of, trying to remember what other songs were programmed. It's been a while, but it was a great record. Irregardless, it was a little bit bittersweet because going through all of that drama, and there was a lot of drama.
It seems a little ironic, too, because, you know, on the early records, that seems like the place where you would have a falling out, you know, where you were doing more intricate parts. But on a record like Chicago 17, you know, Foster, the songs didn't call for a whole lot of complicated playing. And so it's funny that you would have a problem with you at that point in the band's history.
It was more than musical. It was kind of a with butt heads and egos, and you know, I have to. I mean, I can't put it all on David. You know, I don't think that's fair.
Right.
Because I have to take some of the responsibility, especially. But it really put me in a really bad place when I came back from Hawaii. You know, visiting my wife, my second wife, Teddy. They thought she had had Hodgkin's disease potentially, or mono really bad, and so she had to have 6 weeks of rest away from the kids, and it was a really hard time for me. And to come back and find that it had been done behind my back it just blew my mind. I honestly couldn't play anymore. I was so disillusioned, you know. It just threw me into so anger, you know, so many emotions. It was nutty. But and you know, like I say, it was ironic that I was a part of the record and played on
right.
Not everything was programmed. I'd have to go cut by cut, but I don't remember. There was, you know, a lot of overdubbing drums in those days. It was very different. So it was the first time anybody had ever thrown me under the click track, and being as unstable as I was emotionally, it just snowballed and got out of hand. But you know, I'm a better person. I always look at these things like, you know, I know it's a cliche, whatever doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. I mean, it almost killed David. and I'm sure it made both of us stronger. But, you know, it's all food for learning and growing. So I'm here. I'm here, and I'm a better drummer today than I was yesterday. So.
Which I want to get into a little bit, because I think it's interesting how, you know, to borrow a song title from both the album and the current album, you really have come full circle. But, you know, looking at that 17 period for just a little bit longer, you know, you talked about Jeff playing drums on Stay the Night and Carlo playing drums on You're the Inspiration. I'm not looking at liner notes to see if it was credited that way, but it seems like in that period in the 80s, band members started to run into issues with their performances being replaced and being, you know, played by other people.
Yeah, there was a lot of it, and it would be the producers would use that as an excuse to make better records, and maybe they sounded slicker, but you know, they lost a lot of the essence of the band. Ironically, listen, if you look at Chicago 16, David and I had a great time. We hung. We had some headbanging during the negotiations for 17, and you know, it got out of hand, stupid out of hand, you know, and it flowed, and I don't think he'd ever admit to it, but it flowed into the studio, and that was, but 16, we had a great time. I mean, and I played on everything, and it's a great record. It was, and then on the 18, I programmed everything. That's where I really programmed everything. It was all, that's what the 80s was. And, you know, I hated it, honestly.
Yeah.
And I love the records we made with David because they're great records. And I'm thankful. And I brought David in. I'm the one who brought David into the whole thing because I knew we needed a strong producer to get the band back to being creative in the studio and writing great songs again and kicking our butts and getting the best out of us. And we needed a strong producer that we couldn't stare down with our musicianship, so to speak, and David was the guy, and I don't regret that. I don't regret ever bringing him in. Yeah, it didn't go as I planned, especially on 17. 16 was wonderful, and 18 was, you know, Peter had left. Peter was gone for 18, so we held on to David, and we made a good record, but, you know, it was all programmed. It was, I had this most elaborate rig. It was so complicated. But when it worked, it felt like a real drummer, you know, for the most part. But it was very complex. And this way, I got to program the drums instead of some keyboard player. like that. You know, I didn't want to be a keyboard player programming my drum parts. And, you know, I told David that, and he was cool with it. And at one point, he looked at me, and we had cut Niagara Falls or one of the songs off, and he said, "You know, you and I could just cut this record." And I looked at him, and I went, "I thought to myself, are you crazy?" I thought to myself, what has this band come to? You know, it was definitely an unusual time in the band, but especially because, you know, Peter had just left, and man, it was, you know, really difficult. You know, here we are, we clawed and scratched our way back to the top of the mountain with Chicago 16 and then 17, and then Peter leaves, and we're recording Chicago 18 with the new singer Jason, and, you know, of course Bill Champlin was, you know, it was still a great band, but it was a really, really difficult time. I mean, because Peter had come out and gotten out before us and had that huge hit with the Karate Kid song. And, you know, there was a lot of acrimony between Peter and us at that time. And myself, too. I was mad at him for leaving, you know, especially after we were at the top of the mountain, you know. And we fought so hard to get back there. And there, here we are, you know. It was a very difficult time. And very confusing for me and the Warrens, because, you know,
because they were locked out of the studio.
Yeah, the studio was like, basically we were told by radio that if anything you presented with Warrens, we weren't going to play. And so we had to, you know, that's why we were recording these songs with very little brass. And it was like, here we are, a horn band recording, having to record stuff without brass. And that's kind of what the road we took, that was kind of biting our hands, so to speak, because now we were having to conform to pop music rather than being who we were and, you know, just letting it fly, you know. And I think we would have, in hindsight, we chased the hits record too much, and it hurt us. But you know, that's hindsight, and always it's always on Mark. You know, when you're looking back, hopefully it's on Mark. You know, but try to learn from those things.
Well, I'm glad that you can look back at that 18 record positively, because I think that's kind of an underrated record from that period, which it's one that I go back to. And, like, you know, I was thinking about It's All Right, the song that Bill sings from that record. And, I mean, there's good songs on that record, but also, like, being there was your first record with a new singer in the lineup, it's almost better than it has had any chance to be, you know, based on the potential factors that it had working against it, the fact that Peter had left, the fact that you had a new guy, et cetera, all that stuff.
Yeah, I agree. And then subsequently 19, right?
Yeah.
19, mm-hmm. I mean, that was really climbing the mountain. That was one I was so proud of, because, you know, you talk about having your back up against the wall, you know, Peter just leaving, and, you know, 18 was not a successful record in terms of the kind of numbers that we were used to selling, and in millions. And, you know, then we moved on from David, and we that's when we brought in Diane Warren songs with Ron Nevison and Chaz Sanford, and we made a great record. We made a really great record, and we proved that it's all about the music, and it's not about any one individual. That's what Chicago, that was always our strength. So, you know, we you know, once again climbed the mountain, and, you know, I think we had four or five top five records off of that record, four at least. Now, Look Away was number one. I Don't Want to Live Without Your Love, You're Not Alone, and What Kind of Man Would I Be. Those were all top 10 records.
Right.
And it was, you know, and they then, of course, then they fired me. So, you know, that's when that, so it was, you know, it was a great run. I'm really lucky for what I was able to experience and create with the band. And I have to look back on it and be really thankful and to be a part of that legacy, and an important part of that legacy. You know, people consider me to be an important part of the legacy, and it still stands up today. That's the most thing I think I'm most proud of, is 40 years later, I think next year's 45 years for Chicago Transit Authority, those songs still sound great, and they still stand up, and they don't sound old, they sound great, you know? And,
right.
I mean, I believe the work that I'm creating with California Transit Authority is going to have that same longevity. I have no illusions, and selling those kind of numbers in this marketplace today.
Nobody's going to.
Yeah, there aren't many. No, maybe the real big pop acts, but, you know, will their music, I guess the question I ask about today's music is, will their music be thought of and revered, you know, 30 years from now? I mean, I hope so. I want this. I want the young artists of today just to have the advantages that I had. And, you know, not that I didn't fight and work hard for it, but it's really, really tough out there today. I can just tell you.
Before we let go of the 80s, which our friends could tell you that's always hard for me and Matt to do, I want to...
you know, I got that.
I want to say that I think that there's something kind of instructive about what you did during this period. I think it speaks to kind of who you are as a musician, that you went to the trouble of learning how to program your own parts instead of, as you say, letting a keyboard player do it for you. I mean, you had a body of work that spoke for itself. And I think a lot of people in your shoes would have just said, you know what, I'm a drummer, and I've proven that over the last, I forget how many actual studio records Chicago had at that point. But I mean, you didn't have to answer to anybody. You didn't have to answer to a producer, and you didn't need to be replaced by a machine. And yet you worked within the constraints of the period. And I think that's admirable.
Oh, I appreciate that. The truth of the fact is I was being replaced by a machine, and a machine that was being programmed by a non-drummer. And it really angered me. I don't like drum machines. You know, I mean, I know they're here and they're never going away, but why the hell didn't Roger Lynn create a guitar, you know, or, you know, I mean, there are keyboard sequencers, but, you know, it really, I got to tell you how tough it was on us drummers during that time. It galvanized. But right now, you have a stronger drum community than any musical instruments because of the drum machine. We all kind of band together and said, man, we need to share our information and our knowledge. Otherwise, we may be extinct someday. And they couldn't be further from the truth today.
It seemed like that was the danger at the time.
Thank you for the compliment. You know, I've always been a hands-on kind of, I was kind of a control freak too, to be honest. You know, I didn't like losing complete control like that. So, you know, but thank you, appreciate it.
Well, there's a lot to talk about with this new record. I think people have been looking forward to it for a while. If the Full Circle record was kind of you putting your toes back in the water again as far as music making, where was your head at when it came time to make this new record, as far as, you know, what were the things you had taken away from the process of making that last record, good and bad, that you channeled into the sessions for this new record?
Well, the other comparison on this one, I took off my clothes and skinny dipped, you know?
Yep.
So putting your toes up in the water to go and swim in the rock. This record needs to reach a lot more people. That's the real truth of it. And also, I don't know how many of these, I mean, I'm going to be 65 years old. I feel like I am playing better than ever. But I don't know how many of these I really have left, and I want to make it whatever. Every time I walk on stage, I treat it as if it could be the last time, you know? And because you just never know in life when you're going to have things pulled away from you, you know? And so I treat every studio session, every time I step on stage, as if it could be the last. And that's how I play, and that's how, and I know Mark Bonilla, co-producer, and God, without Mark on this record, you know, it wouldn't have happened. He's a phenomenal talent. I mean, Mark arranged of the 13 or 14 tracks. Anyways, 13 or 14, whatever it is, he arranged 9 or 10 of them horn-wise, and he'd never arranged for brass. And if you listen to, like, Full Circle, it sounds like James Panko being channeled, but it's Mark. And Mark, I mean, he's just a remarkable talent and producer, you know. I couldn't ask for a better bandmate. He's a great guy. He's a great human being, and that's true of Peter Fish, who arranged Take Me Back to Chicago. He did the arrangement, and he did the brass for Strike While the Iron's Hot, which is an amazing big band style. I mean, that's a that's as good as anybody in the world could do. You know what I mean? So I'm, and Ed Roth is just a monster keyboard player. Will Champlin, that was such a great, you know, great gift to have Bill Champlin's son. I saw him growing up as a, when I was Bill's bandmate. I mean, he was an infant running around the bus keeping us awake, and here he is. I hadn't talked to Bill for 20 years, and I'll get to that next. And now I'm performing with his son, who's bringing in a whole new youthful energy to this mix of veterans, and it's just made the record, to me, just that much more special.
You mentioned wanting to talk about Bill Champlin being on the record, but I wanted to ask you about Mark Bonilla first, because Matt and I were talking about this earlier today. You know, obviously you started your career with one of rock's best guitarists. And after Terry passed away, there was a shift in Chicago toward the guitar, I think, being deliberately more of a background element. You know, your guitarists often weren't, I guess, quote unquote, full members of the band, or whatever you want to call it. You know, they were kind of in the background, but here you're working with a guy who's very much front and center, and it does feel like the title of the record says, like a full circle experience for you. And I wondered how much of that was on your mind.
Well, from the time that Mark and I connected in 2006 at a jam session, at an impromptu jam session at Greg Bissonette's house, till today, I mean, I feel like I've been kind of reunited with, like Terry, with the musical soulmate, in a sense, like Terry. And it's been a great privilege to work with him, and both in the studio and on stage. I mean, he's such a is he like Terry? I mean, his guitar playing is of a caliber of Terry Katz, and Terry was one of his guitar heroes, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's just a great, you know, I can't tell you how good it is. You know, it's awesome. He's fun to play with. I mean, he's a taskmaster. He really pushes everybody, including himself. He's very, very tough. He can be. If someone comes into the situation cold, they're going to think he's not such a nice guy at times. It couldn't be further from the truth, because he's as hard on himself as he is on everyone else, and I'm the same way. So we really get along that way, although we butt heads at times, really butt heads, and, you know, but at the end of the day, we hug, and, hey, I love you, brother. Okay, you too. Let's just make the music as good as it can possibly be, no matter what it takes, you know. So that's the attitude of this band, and we really, you know, we're operating in a really imperfect world today, and that's another whole podcast or whatever, or interview, really. But to be with Mark Bonilla is a privilege, and this band wouldn't have the level of integrity or intensity without Mark.
It's just nice as a listener to hear you in an environment where the guitar has the opportunity and the responsibility to carry the music to such a large extent.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially on Full Circle, okay?
Yeah.
Full Circle was guitar heavy, man. I love that. But this record, it definitely has strong guitar presence, but the brass presence is really out in your front, your face.
Right, right.
You know, drums. There's rarely no drum solos. I mean, there's a couple of short little things, and that's perfect. I'm not crazy. I like doing drum solos, but on this record, there was some geographical difficulties, because I was living in an apartment at the time, and I couldn't really woodshed, and we weren't playing a lot of gigs, so my chops were not like solo worthy. I mean, they're definitely part worthy and groove in my pocket. So I really didn't lean on the solo on this record. The next record will do some kind of a prolific, unique solo. But
nice.
I'm so proud. I mean, this record is really deep, and I'm proud of that.
Yeah, and you know what? I was floored to hear you say that that Mark had never arranged for horns before, because like the horn arrangements on this record, like for Chicago fans in particular, I mean, just off the charts awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I know I'll make sure he gets a copy of this if he can hear that, because that means he takes great pride in that, and I don't blame him. It's, you know, it was the first time he'd ever arranged brass. When he sent me he did it in synthesizer. He said, "Danny, you got to hear this. I need to know what you think." And I said, "Are you kidding?"
You mentioned Bill, so I want to ask about this because you guys hadn't been in contact, and there's some pretty direct stuff about Bill and the period towards the end of your time in Chicago in your book. You know, what sort of water really had to go under the bridge to, you know, make the guest appearance that we're hearing on this record happen?
Well, you know, there was a guy along with Jason that I felt I would never, didn't want to talk to, didn't want to have anything to do with, and if I ever saw him or talked to him for the rest of my life, I'd be okay. That's how I felt, you know, 10 years ago or more, you know. And our guitar player, Larry Bragg, our singer Larry Bragg, who had done it, was doing some stuff with Bill, and I guess Bill had approached him and said, "Do you think Danny would ever be friends with me again?" Because he was feeling the sting of what he had done, okay? And seeing the results of it in the band, you know, where the direction they had gone. And I said to Larry, I said, "No effing way, you know, no, I don't, you know." And then I stepped back and I thought, "You know, Danny, you've done some things that you're not too proud of, you know, treating people not so good. You know, things that you're unproud of. I mean, and you know, maybe you should consider forgiving, because if you can't forgive somebody else, how can you forgive yourself for some of the things that you know that you're not proud of?" And you know, I can't say, I don't know who's perfect out there, but really none of us is. And some are worse than others, but you know, you have to be able to forgive yourself too, and be deliver yourself. So he, you know, some time passed by, and of course, I had started this band, and we had done Full Circle, and we got our first Facebook page, and he friended me. Okay, and I saw his face there. I didn't say anything, and I sent him a note. I said, "I know you don't feel too good about what you did 20 years ago, or something, whatever it was, but I only have to hear two words, and we can be friends again." And he reached right out and they apologized and said he was sorry for his part in it, and he realized 6 months after he had done it that it was the biggest mistake he'd ever made, because I was a big supporter of his within the band. So we moved on from there and done some gigs together, and I started Full Circle for the first CD, Full Circle. It was the title track that Peter Fish and myself had started writing it. And it's a song about, the backstory of the song is it's about why I quit music, and disillusioned, and I felt that it had abandoned me, and why I came back, and why I had to come back. And so it's a pretty heartfelt, deep song. And so, but anyways, we got about 3/4 of the way through the song, and I'm trying to get it done so I can get it on the record. It's the title track, for Christ's sake. And I couldn't finish it. Got a writer's block, and just so we moved on because we need to get the record out. And time marched on, and we were getting ready to start this record, and we started it. And then Mark took a look at it, and he said, "Hey, I've taken some liberties to add some lyrics, and change some chords, make it a little more rock, and add a section here." And he played it for me. I said, "Wow, that's great. It's even better. It's definitely better." And I finished some more of the lyrics. And then I said to him, I said, "Hey, what do you think of Bill Champlin singing this song?" And he said, "I think it'd be cool." Because Mark is like me, you know, adventurous, always willing to take chances. As you can hear from that first album, we took a lot of chances with classic Chicago songs. So I approached Bill, and he said, "Man, I'd be honored to sing it." And so that's how we got Bill on the record. Well, first we had him singing backgrounds on Sacred Ground, which you can hear. It's got his trademark background. It's Bill,
yep. Up,
an amazing singer. But Full Circle is this. I don't know. Every time I hear it, it brings the hairs on my arm stand up. It's a really great vocal performance and a great song.
It's a sweet story for longtime fans of your work too. And I wanted to touch a little bit on your journey back to music, because as we were talking about before we started recording, you and I spoke back in 94 when you were not playing so much. I think I talked to you after you did a benefit that Tony La Russa set up. But other than that, you were mostly on the management side. And I wondered how gradual your kind of journey back to playing and writing was. You know, how long did it take you to think of yourself as a full-time musician again?
Well, it took a while. I mean, from that point, I don't know what year was it that you interviewed, do you remember?
94.
94, okay. So it took about 6 to 7 years from that point, you know. I was really skirting the issue, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew there was an emptiness inside of me, and that was not playing and expressing myself with music. I did a couple of Broadway plays. I was involved with an independent movie called Lonely Street. I was trying to develop these artists in Colorado, and they were really talented. I mean, that project that I was involved with, and you were talking to, was a country artist that, when I went to Nashville, turned all kinds of people's heads. But, you know, when you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing in life, you're always like a day late and a dollar short. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's that feeling like, you know, man, it's so close. I was just like, the taste of it so close. But, yeah, sorry, kid, it's just not quite there, you know? So I realized that if I'm going to do this, I wasn't getting any younger, that I better get to doing it. And so I came back to L.A., moved back to L.A., and, you know, took the long road back, you know, the long way home.
Well, I've really enjoyed listening to this record, and one of the things that stuck out to me as interesting, because you made it work, is the fact that there are a lot of different singers on this record. How organic was it making it all work in terms of making this feel like an album that was cohesive?
Well, I can tell you, it was difficult. The core components, Mark, myself, Ed Roth, Mick Mahan, who's not touring with us at the time, who is with Pat Benatar on bass, and, you know, Peter Fish was involved a lot. But we just we tried to find the right vocalist for the song, you know, and that's kind of how it worked. And it kind of gives the record a certain eclectic quality that I think is, at the same time, it's pretty cool, you know. So it worked. The answer to your question is we used all of our knowledge and experience in Mark and myself, you know, in running that thread, that common thread. And I have to say, the brass is a big part of it, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Well, hey.
I just gave you that long ass answer to get to the brass. Sorry about that, but that's kind of Danny.
No problem. I think Jeff's got one here.
Yeah, we both wanted to ask you something brass related, actually, because you actually, to go back to that old interview that I did with you, you were talking about someday wanting to do a big band record, and now that we get to hear you in the studio with the horn section again, we wanted to ask you if that was still on your mind, you know, if that was still something that you saw kind of on your plate for a future project.
You know, I would love to do that. And Peter and I talked about that. And Peter's not touring actively with the band. There's a couple of reasons for that. You know, mostly because he's stuck in the studio in New York, but also now that we have a horn section, there's really no need for a second keyboard player live. It just doesn't work.
Right.
But Peter is still a band member, a full band member, and he's just more involved in creative in the studio in that respect. But yeah, there is. I just have to figure out a way to do it in the right approach and doing it in a way where, I don't know, I like to try to do things differently. And not that I'm like some trailblazer, but I want to do it. I'm going to do a big band record. And this record touches on that for sure. The vocalist. And so you just gave me the idea, and yeah, I'm all now I just have to figure out a way to pay for it, that's all.
Well, I...
We'll do a crowdfunding campaign, huh?
Exactly, and you did a little bit. You did a little bit of that with this record, right?
Yep, I was so. What a great experience that was. You know, we raised about a little over $22,000, and it really helped us finish this record the right way. All top cast, all the great, the best engineers, mastered the best way. We started a video, which I want to finish in the next few weeks, and. But it really energized. I believe that it energized the release of this record because it got a lot of people involved and talking about it, and it just was so gratifying. The outreach from friends and fans, and you know, it's a great feeling when you have that kind of support. You know, yeah. A couple of people said, "Well, gee, he's a millionaire. What's it?" And I someone said, "He's been divorced 3 times, pal." and I said, "Yeah, amen. You know, that's the truth. If I was a multimillionaire, I wouldn't be asking for money." Okay, so I'm not complaining. I've had a great life, and I, damn it, I want more. I want to experience playing. I want to get back to the people. I love playing. The one thing I really missed with Chicago, besides the camaraderie. When the band was in that mode, you know, when the band was really tight as brothers, it was the audience, the interaction with the audience, and you know, I'm getting a bit of that, actually a lot of that now with CTA, and I want more. I want more. I want to be closer to the people. I want to see us, you know, playing on bigger stages. I want to see us performing for larger audiences, and this band deserves it. These guys deserve it. They've worked hard their whole their career. They deserve to have a taste of some real success. Yeah?
Well, I think Jeff and I, if you get that crowdfunding thing going for a big band record, we'll be a couple of the first people in line to help with that, because you touched on it, but I definitely do hear elements of the possibilities of a project like that, listening to this record, stuff like the beginning of Take Me Back to Chicago and Prime Time. So I would love to see, you know, where you would go full blown.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I haven't, honestly, I can't even think about it right now because there's so much with going into this record, getting into the people, but the response right now so far is awesome. The response is like overwhelmingly positive. So, you know, we've hired a couple of PR people, and by the way, that crowdfunding campaign paid for a chunk of that, you know?
Nice.
I had to figure out how to pay for the rest of it, but we'll figure a way, you know? I mean, it's the way this record has gone. I mean, really, I was a counselor at the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, and one of the campers, they call them campers, was being brutalized by his counselor, and he's a drummer, young drummer. He's a very, you know, young drummer. He's not that young, but he's a neophyte as a drummer, and the guy was terrorizing him. I took him aside and started working with him and relaxed him and got him grooving, and turns out, and he ends up writing me a big check to start the record, you know, he invested, and we're now really close friends, and he's an investor in this record, and it's that kind of belief, you know, that really makes these things happen these days, you know.
Yeah, I want to ask you about crowdfunding, because now that you've done this and now that you've experienced it and you're seeing this kind of feedback and, you know, surely you must have known that all these years there was a real thirst among your fans to hear you and anybody else connected with Chicago doing this kind of live band in the studio music. It's tempting to imagine what might have been if this had been an avenue for you guys to pursue during the 80s, you know, if you didn't have to worry about making concessions to radio. It's hard not to wonder what kind of path the band might have taken if you guys had been able to crowdfund your records then.
Yeah. Yes, but it was such a different business. So many different players. The record companies were making money hand over fist, okay?
Right.
They were paying off radio stations hundreds of thousands of dollars to get stuff played, you know? I mean, it's a totally different game, you know, and that hasn't completely gone away, because I think to a certain degree, some of it's still happening, but they, you know, the advent of Napster and then the collapse of the record company model, and artists have suffered immensely because of it. But you're right. There's a freedom to today's music that we always wanted, you know. But now we've got it, and it, I mean, I love the freedom. But what I don't like is all the other stuff that goes along with it. It's like you have to really be focused, and you have to know your priorities. And it's so easy to get backed up into the business side and everything that has to be done to where you're not creating. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword, and there's no real easy answer. I guess the short answer is it just wouldn't have worked then, because how could you expect people to contribute? I mean, they're not investing because they're making a donation, when record companies will be making millions of dollars, you know? And, yeah, you know, there's a chance that this record can go through the roof. It's that good. But, you know, 10% of it's going to go to the Fender Foundation, you know, the Music Foundation. And, you know, it's basically, CCA is, I can honestly tell you, it's a non-profit organization. In fact, it's a no-profit organization. You know, that needs to change, because we live in a world where, you know, you need those fun tickets to pay your rent and, you know, fly in an airplane and put food on the table. And the same, music has been so devalued. Yep. And you guys have know this. You've been around, because you've been around. You've seen, been through the different eras. It has been so devalued. It's, for a guy like me, to see what's going on with musicians playing for, great musicians playing for $100 a night, you know, their club owners grinding, and it sickens me in some respects, you know. So, I mean, but the crowdfunding thing is the other side of that. It's the fans. It's the people that love music supporting it. And then giving it life, and what's going to happen beyond us? I don't know. What do you think? What do you think is going to happen? You guys probably have a better finger on the pulse than I do.
It's going to be hard for bands your size to support themselves, that's for sure. But I have my fingers crossed that you can make it work. I mean, it's really, really satisfying to listen to this record after all this time of waiting to hear something like this. It feels good. It feels real good.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot to me. And I know it to the rest of the guys in the band. It means a lot. And, you know, just keep doing what you're doing and spreading the word. I guess that's what it's going to take.
I want to wrap up with just a couple things. And, you know, first of all, ask, you know, it seems like you guys are in a very prolific period with this band. Is there more material than what wound up on this record? I mean, have you already started thinking towards another record?
No, we haven't. So much went into this record. Right now, what's going on is what we want to do is get out and get this record to the people. And we're really working on a live show, and the band's performing better than ever. I mean, you know, as far as the way we perform, so to speak, our show is just playing the music great, looking good, and playing it to the people, you know, not turning our back to the people. I mean, that's really our idea. And we have a couple of singers. We have Wes Crave, who sang the several thousand on the last record, and then he sang Daydream Lover, the bonus track on it. And then, obviously, Will Champlin is performing with us a lot. So it's, you know, vocally, we've never been better, and that's instrumentally, the band has always been strong, but vocally now we're really strong.
Yeah, Will seems like he's added a really cool energy to this band. You touched on it a little bit earlier, but the songs that he, you know, helped to co-write and sing on are great ones on this record.
I agree. Yeah, Strike While the Iron Hot is a very cool song, and I'm really proud of the way that came in the last minute, and I fought to get it on the record. Yeah, it was a fight, really. I just said, listen, we got to record this. I believe it. You know, this is the kind of song that could, you know, whatever, a hit song of these days, and I say it's a hit song, and I'm not sure what that means, you know. It probably means it could get into a movie or a theme song for a TV show, or, you know, who knows, you know, because it's a great tune.
Well, two final things here. I'll just ask, since we talked some about Bill, I think you've had some interaction with Kenny Cetera in recent years. Do you see any possibility of, you know, pulling Peter back towards the studio?
You know, I've approached Peter a couple of times, and he's turned me down twice, two or times, and I've given up, to be honest with you. I just think Peter wants to do his own thing, and that's it. Peter's an odd duck in a sense, but he's a lone wolf. You know, he's a good guy. I respect him. I've made great memories with the guy, but I don't think he really wants anything more to do with recording with me or working with me. That's just for whatever reason. I mean, I think you have to ask him, but yeah. I really don't know. So the short, I mean, I'd have to say probably not. I mean, he's welcome. You know, and you never know with Peter. Peter's the kind of guy that could show up at a gig and sit in and say, "Okay, let's do a record." I mean, that, you know, he's not he's unpredictable in that respect. But I don't see it happening. No.
Well, final bit here. How much of the new record are you guys doing in the live show?
A lot.
Nice.
We're doing Prime Time, Take Me Back, Real World, The Real World, Out of Reason, Strike While the Iron's Hot, Go On. I want to learn, I'll tell you what I really want to learn, I think it's going to be great for the live show, is Staring at the Sun. I think that is such a kick-ass song. I know it's going to go over great live, and the band's going to play it great live.
Oh, yeah.
As far as I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know, man, we need Larry Braggs for that. And, you know, I think we'll be doing more gigs with Larry, you know, when he's available, and you know, when he's not working with the tower, and we have the, you know, because we love Larry. Larry's a brother, you know.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that Prime Time's in the set, because that's a really cool, and it really gives you guys a chance to let loose a little bit.
Yeah, and it's great to hear somebody say that. Like, Prime Time goes over really well, but you know, it's generally it takes a certain ear to appreciate it. Thank you, I appreciate that.
Well, why don't we wrap it up there, man? You've been generous with your time, and, you know, it's been a lot of fun talking with you, for sure.
You too, guys. I've really enjoyed it as well. I sure as hell hope this recording... I'm watching the meters, and it's working, but I'll check it. And then, again, I appreciate the respect, guys, and for the music and the support for the music. It means the world to me, and I can't thank you how much. I appreciate it. And
it's great to hear new music from you.
Yeah, I look forward to it. And really... when we're in the area, please come by, okay?
We'll do.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, this new music gave us the opportunity, so it's great to have that opportunity to talk about new music, so.
Exactly.
Thank you. All right, guys. Have a great day, huh?